Hello, and welcome to Real Menopause Talk. My guest today is Jodie Patterson. Brought up in 1970s New York in an actively black family where cultural heritage was something to be celebrated in the day-to-day living of life, she comes from a long line of impressive activists and entrepreneurs. And she herself is an impressive activist, entrepreneur, mum to 5 children who are currently aged 30 all the way down to 14, all with a very active and full life. This episode is not all about menopause. It is about identity, freedom, creativity, community, learning, transition, transformation, and how it's all an inside job. We can be who we are from the inside out. First of all then, Jodie, thank you so much for your time and for agreeing to have conversation. I have been so excited about this and really looking forward to meeting you, so thank you. Would you like to tell everybody a little bit about yourself, about growing up in 1970s New York, so that people get a sense of who you are?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for having me. I love meeting people that I don't know, and I feel like we're going to get to know each other really well today. I'm Jodie Patterson. I'm a native New Yorker. Diehard New Yorker. I grew up in the 70s on the Upper West Side. I was raised very New York. During a time when there were really strong communities in New York. So the Upper West Side represented a very diverse group, religiously, ethnically, visually diverse. A lot of artists, more Black folks than on the Upper East Side. If you know the difference in New York, Upper East Side was like very posh and very white. And so my parents raised us intentionally on the Upper West Side. And although I'm a native New Yorker, my family is very Southern. So my mom is from the South and she raised us with a lot of Southern values and culture. And I went down South a lot in the summers to be with my grandmother and my great grandmother. So I'm a Northerner, but I have Southern roots. I was raised by what I like to call an actively Black family, where many of my relatives were civil rights leaders. And so, of course, I knew the stories of my grandmother, Gloria, going up against hospitals and school boards and winning those court cases during the segregated South. And in fact, Dr. Martin Luther King dubbed my grandmother Ms. Revolution for her fight in equality. And then my uncle was the musician Gil Scott-Heron, who wrote "The Revolution Will Not Be Televised." My father formed the first Black brokerage firm on Wall Street because he understood financial security to be revolutionary for Black families. So I come from a line of change makers, of disruptors, who were sort of shaping the world to be a better place. And then at home, when I say actively Black, I mean the art on the walls, the books that we talked about at the dinner table, the music, the culture. I mean, so many Black celebrities I literally thought were my relatives because we talked about them with such affection. I mean, Nina Simone, you know, I thought she was my auntie. Roberta Flack, I remember looking at her album covers and thinking they were just art, pieces of art of my auntie. So there was everything that we did, breathed, talked about, listened to, looked at in my home had an essence of Black pride. And so I grew up, although in a very white neighborhood, in a white upper middle class community of New York, in many respects, from my private schools to our vacations to our neighborhoods, culturally, as a family, we were solidified in Blackness.
I've heard you talk about the strength of Black community globally as well, and walking into a room with all your ancestors and your cohort and everybody you can think of with you there in essence, which is the most beautiful image, as well as your family being so strong, particularly the women, the men obviously, and your father. It's remarkable Gil Scott-Heron, I'm sure many, many people know. With that line of heritage, with so many really powerful matriarchs in your family, how did you sculpt yourself so that you fitted in and are the woman you are today?
Well, it's interesting how I recognize that my family is very matriarchal. I mean, the women owned property, the women were teachers, they were professors, they were landowners, business owners. They ran the churches, they ran their family finances. The women in my family really pushed us forward. That's not to take away anything from the men, but, and oftentimes this was the case in Black families because Black women could be domestic workers. Black women could do more things in the white community than Black men. So my family did have a strong matriarchal lineage, and all of the women were very proud to be women. My sisters, my cousins, my aunts, and great grandmothers. And I never thought of the difficulties of being a woman. It always felt very powerful, very creative, very communicative, and very essential to the world around me. I went to an all-girls high school, Convent of the Sacred Heart. I went to an all-women's college, Spelman College. My motto was growing up and as a young adult, if you stick with women and if you stick with Black people, you'll be great. And that was my community. And it wasn't to deny any other communities, but those two, women and black families, was the community that I felt would always understand me, have my back, support me in what I thought would possibly be, a very interesting road for a Black woman. Come to find out, I didn't even have a clue what I was up against, when I landed in my 30s and 40s.
Right from the very beginning, your Spelman years, because I have read your book, which is so beautiful, and I encourage every single person to get a copy of The Bold World. It is extraordinary in so many ways. So your Spelman years, you're surrounded by these amazing sisters. You have a real sense of sisterhood. I've lost my train of thought. This happens so often. I'm afraid it is a proper perimenopause.
Still the menopause. The world. I'm the same way. I'm like, and then what were we talking about?
The world drops out of my head so regularly.
So we're talking about community and sisters and how I wedged myself into the world as a woman. You know, that world wasn't even big enough when it came to the issues that I was facing with my family. That world that had always served me and that community was not wide enough to help me puzzle out this new question I had around gender, specifically with my son, my child, who was saying, I'm not a girl, I'm a boy.
One of the quotes from your book is, who am I in this world? Mm. What does it mean to be a woman? So you're surrounded by wonderful, powerful women, mostly Black women. Mm-hmm. And I have seen through your telling of your story, the answer to this changes. Because you are with Serge, your first husband, for a while,
and just to note, Serge is Swiss and Vietnamese, so that's that
amazing combination. Wow, you have a whole load of transitions and transformations throughout your life. Mm-hmm. Then you arrive at a whole new junction where you have bigger questions. Mm-hmm. That what does it mean to be a woman? Your answers change and expand.
I think at the time when I was leaving one marriage, well, my first marriage was pure joy, pure love, and pure naivete. I mean, I met my soon-to-be husband when I was 16 and dated through parts of college and then moved in together right after college. And we really thought the world was ours to have and to enjoy and to share forever together. But what I soon found out was love is love, and then there's power dynamics. And so I experienced, and he was 9 years older, and really solidified in his career, and I was a newbie in this adult world. So the power dynamics were not equal, and I found myself shifting and shaping around his needs and his career and his schedule. And his personality was really growing. His personality and his career was growing while mine was, I felt more contained. I had to be around the house. I had to be around the baby. And I was always working. I had jobs and career and entrepreneurial startups from as far back as I can remember, But I also had the confines of a new baby, being at home, nursing, making sure I could do everything with the baby. And then on top of that, if I had some extra space, I could launch a business, which I always did, but it was a struggle. So I saw the power dynamics between men and women in my first relationship. And then when we decided to split up and I went into my second relationship, I married a man who was African. And the power dynamics between male and female continued. And they even actually deepened. And so I started to wonder, for the first time, I was looking at myself as a woman, but with the gaze of a man, of mm-hmm. the male gaze. In my family, I was more than likely with women around me, more than not. And now in my relationships as a wife, I was directly in comparison to my husband. And I felt that that question of what does it mean to be a woman was really relevant at the time. Is it about my power? Is it about how I can maneuver around the obstacles? Is it about just letting me be free to make my own decisions regardless of the consequences? Tough questions mm-hmm. when you're young. Yeah,
absolutely. And then they come back, and most often perimenopause seems to present the question where we do look at our lives, we look at where we are, and we ask ourselves who we are all over again with different life experience behind us and underneath us. And obviously the answers are going to be different.
Yes. And I think, you know, I mean, I have a different take on that. Like, what does it mean to be a woman now than I did 10 years ago when I was first starting to raise my children? And I think a lot of the way I define myself now is genderless in a sense. Mm-hmm. And I learned this over the last decade, raising children that were insisting on defying norms. And of course, I'm familiar with defying norms from my extended family, but as I was raising my children, I was realizing that they were not fitting into gender norms. I'm raising one trans person and one genderqueer person and three others that define in all sorts of ways. But as I look at what I'm responsible for now, it is not I don't see myself as the doting mother, full of affirmation and snuggles. I really see my role as a mother, as an architect, as a designer, as a developer, as a someone who's growing a little mini city of individuals. And so I think about my job as growing people, as developing and building people. And that to me is genderless. So I don't always do the roles. In fact, sometimes I reject the roles right now that are specifically put aside for women. And I have other people in my family do those roles, whether it's the boys or their father at this point, their fathers. But I think, you know, when I was thinking about what does it mean to be a woman, I was really looking at these very specific gender roles that I had learned growing up. You know, that women can be the emotional stabilizers and the organizers and the computer network systems mm-hmm. for the entire family. But what I've also learned is that we can architecturally build our children up, our homes, our communities, our boardrooms, and that type of power, that type of skill set is really, really exciting for me, much more than any other parenting scenario has been in a long time.
And that's exactly what you needed to do when Penelope came to you and told you that he was a boy. At the age of 3, you built your community. How did that begin? How did you realize that was going to be a necessary part of your skill set?
So much of what happened with my children hit like a tsunami. It wasn't a slow gradual. It didn't feel slow and gradual. It didn't feel like I had time to think about things and puzzle things out and take these baby steps, because we were looking at 10 years ago, a very difficult time, even more so than now in many ways, difficult time for people who are trans and non-binary. And so when my kids said to me, I'm not a girl, I'm a boy, they also said, I don't want tomorrow to come. I don't want to look like you tomorrow. I want to be daddy. I don't want to be you, mommy. I love, but I don't want to be you. And so those words were shocking and dangerous. And I didn't want any death on my watch. And so I jumped into action. And what that took was me unlearning things, or agreeing to put some definitions on the side and agreeing that there's room for new definitions. So I literally have to turn the world upside down. If my daughter is my son, mm-hmm. what else in the world do I know? And I left everything open for grabs. And I reconstructed in many ways the way we ran our family, the way I interacted in the world, the things I was allowing my child to now do as a boy. And it sounds like, it sounds strange because intellectually we know we shouldn't raise our children with bias, but the bias is there.
It is.
So we're gendering from the beginning. We're raising girls to be girls or to be young women, and we're raising boys to be young men. And that comes with a code of conduct. And I had to strip that away mm-hmm. in many respects and allow my child to allow my child the space to roam in areas, communities, activities that I would not have normally done so if I were raising a little girl. It sounds bonkers, but it was a decoding of my entire system and then a rebuilding based on new principles and new beliefs.
It really doesn't sound that bonkers at all, because I think particularly our generation, much as we might not behave in the way that our mothers or grandmothers did, sort of super traditional, it is in our DNA to a certain extent that women have certain roles and men have certain roles. And sure. Now we're expanding our experience and our vocabulary, thank goodness, but mm-hmm. it's uncharted territory.
It is.
And there is one part in your book where you mentioned that you as a family go to trans camp.
I do.
Which is the most bonkers sounding yeah. experience to begin with. And it's so positive. And the people you meet, one in particular stuck in my mind. If memory serves me correctly, they're a boy who also was assigned female mm-hmm. at birth. And they state very clearly that they don't want to change their body because they are who they are.
Yes. It blew my mind.
Yes. Mine just reading it. You were actually there physically, but just reading it, this is extraordinary and so positive. How does a person navigate that? Because with the biology, so periods, menopause, yeah. there is a certain inevitability. So how do you navigate that? And how are you going to help your son, Penelope?
Well, you know, I think what I've learned is that there are a million plus ways to experience life. And to try to design it for an individual because you think you understand what their obstacles are is impossible. And so, of course, when I started off on this, I was looking for really positive images of trans adults who were successful and happy and had relationships and careers and traveled and were engaged in life. And I found those people. And the interesting thing was each story is so wildly different. So there's this one kid who said, look, I am a trans man. This is my body. So therefore, this body is the body of a man, and I'm not changing it. I'm not having top surgery. I'm not having bottom surgery. I'm just living my life with this body as a man. For me, that was mind-blowing because coming from this culture, we hyper-focus mm-hmm. on the body. The body tells us who the person is, from the skin color to the shape of their body to their hair, their features, right? And so I was naively thinking that trans-identified people would automatically address their bodies first as a part of their transition. And then come to find out, not all do. I mean, it's like, it's one of those moments that is so like, of course not in retrospect, but it was mind-blowing that we can be who we are from the inside mm-hmm. out. That the brain, the mind, the spirit really controls everything, and the body is secondary. And so how we see ourselves is an internal process. And really, this is what my uncle, Gil Scott-Heron, was saying. The revolution will not be televised. Meaning it comes, all of the revelations and all of the transformations come mm-hmm. from the inside. And they have much less to do with the physical aspects of life. And so, you know, when I started to think that we can do this human experience any way we choose, it freed me up to not be so worried about my own son's transition. And I won't specifically talk about his transition, but I will say that the things that I was worried about, hormone therapy and testosterone and estrogen and surgery, those things don't bother me anymore. They don't make me nervous. There's enough research and enough experience on the plate to have a good roadmap for my children. There's a lot of different ways to address the outward transitioning. But one thing, and this is maybe a little bit off topic, but one thing I wanted to bring up is the hypocrisy around this. Because as a 53-year-old woman, I'm in menopause. And if I want to, I can tap the computer and make a phone call and find myself on hormone therapy fairly easily. Mm-hmm. And then my son or my friends who are trans have a lot harder time accessing same hormones, same hormone therapy. And so we allow this to be a normal part of the aging cisgender woman's life, but we don't allow it. We police it for the trans community. There's also a lot of body alterations that cis people like myself do. In fact, we do more gender-affirming surgeries than the trans community. We change our lips to fit our version of femininity. We change our breasts. We sometimes change our rib cage. We change our butts and our noses, our jawlines, our hairlines, all to fit mm-hmm. our version of femininity or masculinity. And it's just seen as cosmetic surgeries that we have a right to access. And then if my son decides to, or if my friends who are trans decide to, there's a barrier around that. So these are some of the things that I started noticing raising children that are very diverse.
It's such an interesting part of the conversation. I was talking about this with a friend the other evening, actually, about definitions of feminine and masculine as well. And it's purely what we've constructed over the years as what is feminine. It doesn't necessarily mean anything at all.
Right. And also what I've also noticed that we've decided that there's a cap on how strong, for example, a woman can be mm-hmm. or how emotional a man can be. Mm-hmm. And then we've told ourselves that anything outside of that cap is abnormal. But our children are defying those stereotypes. I mean, I'm looking at my children and they're not limiting their physical ability to a gender. They're not limiting their emotional ability to a gender. And they're saying and this is why I think, you know, Gen X and Gen Z are so heavy, predominantly queer accepting. They're just saying, forget all these stupid stereotypes, forget all these stupid boxes. We're far beyond those lines of demarcation. And they're opting out for this umbrella title of queer. They're saying we're limitless. And I think that's where you get a lot of the young folks' definition of queer, queer as in freedom.
When you are in company that is accepting and that isn't maybe afraid and certainly mm-hmm. judgmental, it makes for so much more of an interesting life and interesting conversations. It's just finding
so
the
right.
people. Yeah. You mentioned menopause already as well. And you've been an advocate for talking about menopause as well as so many other issues, and obviously speaking for queer and trans folk as well. What makes you so passionate about causes?
Oh my gosh, that's a great question. I have followed passion the majority of my life. And I went back to actually count how many jobs I've held and how many houses I've lived in. It was like 17 jobs and like 20 houses. I'm a person who shifts a lot and who moves a lot, and who follows an instinct quite often. You won't see me attached to a company or a position in my past for more than 2 or 3 or 4 years. I mean, I really moved around. And at one point I thought that might be a little flaky, but now I see it as really, because I have some hindsight now. I can look back over 20 years. And in fact, when I was writing the book, I was taking a very deep dive look over those past 40 years. And what I see as the thread line that goes throughout is curiosity. And so I've been following passion. I love music. And so I worked in the music industry. I love nightlife, and specifically New York City downtown nightlife. And so I'm a co-owner of a music venue called Joe's Pub. I love beauty. I love doing my children's hair. You know, hair in the Black community is a language in and of itself. And so I started a beauty company. And then as I saw my family starting to diversify and my family starting to really raise their hand, my family members raising their hands and saying, I'm not who you think I am. I'm something different. That led me into activism. I like to puzzle out the deeper meaning of things, and I like to be instrumental in bridging world. So as I'm experiencing an aha moment, I'm sharing it with the world, and then I'm perhaps bringing cultures together around this new piece of information. So that's how I got to this point in my life where I am an activist, an author, an entrepreneur, a mother, a public speaker, a writer.
I think it's wonderful. Yes, of course. I like following passion. I think mm-hmm. that's a really, really intriguing and compelling way of putting it as well. And so many successes along the way.
I've learned to measure success differently as well. You know, because a lot of my friends have stayed in one career for 20, 30 years. And when you stay in a career for 20 and 30 years, like some of my friends have done, you have a depth to your success. I mean, you can count the ups and the downs, and you can really draw on your wisdom in that one field. And I've done a lot of fields, mm-hmm. And I did not stay in one space. And so I had to really define my successes differently. And I think my success came over time. I didn't have enormous success in publishing. I didn't have enormous success as an athlete. I had successes, but the depth of my, or the breadth of my success has been in this like very expansive life that I now can pull together. So it's not like, you know, I am the New York Times bestselling author, but I'm an author among many other things. And I bring all of that together. And I've had to really find that interesting. I cannot compare myself to some of my female women friends who are just at the top of their career in one thing, and they blow everyone else out of the park in that one area. I'm more of a person who experiences life as a starfish, where I spread out and I'm going to touch every part of life. I'm not going to be in one area. I'm going to be in all the areas.
There is so much more that I want to talk about and ask about and could literally for days and days and days, but I'm aware we're running out of time. So where are you going to starfish next?
Oh my gosh, I have so many plans. I mean, I have, I've written this book, The Bold World, which was picked up by HBO, and they gave me a grant to develop it for television. And so that is a challenge to take my literary work and think about it for television. So I'm working right now with a team to take my story to television as a scripted series. That's a lot of fun. I've got some kids going to college. I've got some kids abroad. And so I plan to be traveling a lot and writing a lot and loving a lot. I also, you know, one of the things in my life that's important to me is to be a lover. I mean, I'm a lover of experiences, a lover of travel, but also a lover of people. And so many times when you think of a divorced single mom, you think she's at the end of her road. But I've learned recently, I'm not dead yet. I will continue to have boyfriends, perhaps get married again. It's one of the things I really enjoy. And I bring that to the table because it's not the thing that women talk about after their kids are, you know, grown up and they've divorced several times. But I'm still a lover. And I continue to be that part of, I continue to nurture that part of my life.
And it shows. It really does. It's wonderful. Thank you so much for your time, Jodi. I really appreciate it.
I really appreciate that. And thank you for sharing my book. Thank you for inviting me on so I can talk a little bit about all the things that are in my head. Women, older women being a big part of my thoughts these days. So thank you.
Oh, no, thank you. We'll have to talk again. But thank you, Jodi.
Thanks, Hattie.
Thanks. Take care.
Bye.
Bye. You can find Jodi on Instagram at Jodi Patterson and The Bold World wherever you choose to get your books. A quick reminder about Real Menopause Therapy, an opportunity to handpick your own therapy for support on the inside job. You can match them to your needs, environment, and interests so you meet someone who understands the whole you. Subscription is currently free. Sign up is obligation-free as well, so you can just have a look around and see how it works. Go to bit.ly/RMtherapy, that's bit.ly /RMtherapy, capital R, capital M, capital T. Thank you for listening. I look forward to seeing you in the next episode.